morning. Please be seated. Welcome to the Court of Appeals. It is Wednesday, February 26, 2020. The first matter on the calendar for argument today is the case of John Becker versus Pablo Murillo. Counsel, you each have 15 minutes to present your arguments. It's important that you state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your arguments. Your timing will be indicated in the lighting at the podium, and the podium may be raised and lowered to meet your needs. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Your honors, my name is Nicholas Henry, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Pablo Murillo. I want to thank you for taking the time today to hear our little matter. This case presents some interesting questions in my mind. The statute is pretty clear on what is required to constitute behavior or words or conduct that would justify a harassment restraining order. There are repeated incidents of intrusive or unwanted acts, words, or gestures that have a substantial adverse effect or are intended to have a substantial adverse effect on the safety, security, or privacy of another.
To get to repeated, is two enough to be repeated under the case law?
I'm sorry, what?
Two incidents enough to constitute repeated incidents?
Two incidents, I would say, yeah. The question remains is whether two incidents actually happened in this case. Or whether even one happened, for that matter. I think it's arguable that there was no threat made at all by Mr. Murillo against Mr. Becker at either the June 8th or the July 18th meetings at his shop or at the July 25th City Council meeting.
The district court made findings that they were, correct?
Well, that's an interesting you brought that up because I intended to bring this up later. I'm a little embarrassed at myself, actually, that I just noticed this yesterday. But if you look at Exhibit 1 of our addendum, it's the order that was filed by the court after the hearing. And in section number 2, there's a number of boxes that the judge can check for reasonable grounds and findings. And threats are not checked off. The only thing checked there is uninvited visits to the petitioner as follows at his business. So I'm not even sure the district court found there was threats.
Well, if you turn the page, though, he's checked other. And written something in there.
Okay, and then he said he felt threatened at the city council meeting. So we have one instance that there's a finding for.
There's the business and there's the city council.
Well, and that's my point is what can we really constitute what happened on July 18th at the visits to the shops as.
Apparently, the judge thought there were two instances, and the judge made credibility determinations and credited the respondent's testimony over your client's testimony.
But he based his findings in part on the subjective feelings of Mr. Becker, and that's not what the law requires. The law requires that the conduct must be objectionably threatening or objectionable, and the person receiving the threats or whatever they might be is objectively threatened.
He said it was not unreasonable for Mr. Becker to feel threatened with the accumulation of those events.
He also said it would be reasonable for people to think there was no threatening behavior.
I agree. He did say that not everyone would have taken Mr. Murillo's conduct or actions in the same way, but it was not unreasonable for Mr. Becker to feel threatened with the accumulation of those events.
So then the question remains is, can a meeting that's been described only as cordial and non-threatening later be determined to be threatening somehow based on some later conduct?
Well, but to be fair, Mr. Becker's testimony was about the uninvited, if you will, business meeting down in Rochester. He testified, for the most part, the meeting was very cordial, but his testimony went on to discuss particular aspects of that conversation that he thought were odd and made him feel uncomfortable enough to mention it to another city council member that same day who said, yeah, you should tell the police about those statements because they're threatening.
Which then goes into the analysis of Durham and Rohr about the constitutionality. And the respondent made a good deal of effort in their brief to talk about how we didn't make a constitutional argument in our case. And that's true, we didn't. The reason we cited to that constitutionality analysis in Durham and Rohr is that it brings up that the statute is intended to apply to true threats and fighting words. Words that spoken that would objectively make a reasonable person feel like they need to fight to protect themselves or feel reasonably threatened enough to take action and respond.
But didn't the Dunham Court also go on to say that speech or conduct that is intended to have a substantial adverse effect is not protected speech?
But it also said that Minnesota NICE is not required by the law. So it has to go above and beyond just mere outburst. A person's allowed to be outraged, is what the Dunham Court said. And I don't think at any time Mr. Murillo expressed anything even remotely close to outrage.
Well, but by making the comment, the odd comment about his wife and the home invasion and how people in Colombia have their own form of justice, I mean, in the context of trying to put the pressure onto Mr. Becker to vote in favor of your client's project, I mean, in context, why is it not the case that those words were intended to or did have a substantial adverse effect on Mr. Becker's sense of security?
Well, with respect to at least the Colombia comment, Mr. Murillo denied ever saying it. Moreover, he's from Bolivia, not Colombia. It doesn't stand to reason to me that he would mistake his own country of birth. All of the statements that we have in this were given by Mr. Becker, and they were all either denied or put into context by Mr. Murillo.
Well, that's the rub for you, isn't it? Because the judge credited Mr. Becker's statements.
In so many words, but it still doesn't stand to reason that Mr. Murillo would mistake his own place of birth. And those statements were put into context. The story about the home invasion, for example, we include in our addendum the cartoon that went around in the Red Wing Republican Eagle. They were really disgusting, quite frankly. It shows Mr. Murillo driving a bus with people doing drugs and drinking alcohol with bags of money. And the implication is that the affordable housing unit that he intended to build there would bring in large amounts of crime to the area. Mr. Murillo knew that Mr. Becker was concerned about that, so he was trying to assuage his concerns on that by saying, I also experienced a home invasion. My wife was injured in that home invasion. I have no interest whatsoever in bringing that kind of element into the neighborhood. That Mr. Becker mistook that took that in some other way, I don't think we can put that on Mr. Murillo.
Although, again, the statute talks about conduct that is intended to or has the effect of. And so, I mean, even if we agree with you that the record wouldn't show that Mr. Murillo was intending to cause Mr. Becker concern, there is evidence in the record that Mr. Becker was concerned by the comments on July 18th.
And it comes back to whether that question was reasonable or not, and that's not a question for this court. But the statute also says that we're only allowed to take the subjective intent of the person making the statements into consideration, and I don't believe that was done here. Whether the statements were threatening or not, I don't think they were. I disagree that the July 18th statements were anything or remotely coming close to that. When they're described as cordial and he thinks nothing of it, and then later, after this incident at the city council, where Mr. Murillo made a statement again, and it's only in the words of Mr. Becker that we have these statements, that your numbers are effed. I'm not going to use the full word in front of the court. Mr. Murillo says, I never said that. I might have said their numbers are false, but I was happy. We just won the vote. Why would I be threatening him at that point?
Well, isn't the statement about you better pray or something like that, that was the more threatening context, more concerning statements in terms of Mr. Becker?
If it was said that way, Mr. Murillo claims that he said, you pray and I'll pray. We all need to pray over this. When Mr. Becker pointed it out to the Red Wing Chief of Police, who went and talked to Mr. Murillo immediately after that, and came back and said, there's no threat. Later, he talked to the county attorney who said, there's no threat. A Red Wing City police detective investigated the matter briefly and said, there's nothing here. So the only person we have feeling threatened is Mr. Becker. And we've got three non-involved people all looking into this, making reasonable assertions that there was no threat. So whether that conduct falls under the statute, I can't think that it does. If you've got three people looking at this who weren't a part of it saying, that's not a threat, I don't think we can say it was reasonable and objective that the statements were threatening. Whether it was made in the heat of the excitement of the city council meeting, sure. But like Mr. Murillo said, he just won the vote. He had no reason to threaten Mr. Becker at that point.
Well, he had won the vote, but there weren't there conditions attached to the approval that he wasn't happy about?
Well, he wasn't thrilled by it. He wanted everything he wanted, but he got what he got, and he was happy with what he got. He said we could work with that. So it's. I don't think it's reasonable to say that even if Mr. Becker felt threatened by those comments, that those comments were objectively threatening.
And that's a factual issue, right? I mean, it's highly contextual, and it depends on one's interpretation of the testimony.
It is.
And the district judge was in a far better position than we are to interpret the evidence, right?
Sure. And I don't think it's up to this court to reinterpret the evidence. That's not your place. Your role is to look at the full record and determine whether these are repeated incidents of harassment sufficient to satisfy a restraining order.
Taking the evidence in the light most favorable to the order.
Correct. Unfortunately, correct, from my perspective at least. It seemed to me, when I found out about the ruling of the judge, and I told the judge the standard of law in the trial, that he didn't really give enough credence to the objective standard of it. Would not just any reasonable person, but a number of reasonable people, hearing that, think that was actually threatening, and he intended for a substantial impact on his security, safety, or privacy. And with respect to the stalking incidents, it's worth noting that, and I'm running out of time here, so I'll make this quick. These happen in public places of businesses that are open to the public. It'd be an interesting standard to say that somebody couldn't come into a public shop and speak to the owner without first being invited. I mean, that any window shopper would have to ask the business owner's permission before going into the shop. So I don't think we can uphold the stalking at all here.
What do you think of Ms. Polinchek's testimony that she felt disconcerted after your client and Mr. White were at the shop?
Well,
and
that's one.
That your client was quite excitable.
And when taken in context with the rest of her testimony, she felt disconcerted because she didn't know why they were there. She didn't understand what they were looking for. And yes, she said he was excitable, but he didn't seem threatening or agitated or anything like that. He just seemed excited about what he was talking about and eager. So I don't think that I'm not saying we can't put credence into what Ms. Polinchek talks about, but we need to take her comments in full context. She also called Mr. Becker at the Rochester location, and apparently he told her that he didn't want them coming down, but she never conveyed that to Mr. White and Mr. Murillo. She just said, yeah, he's down at the Rochester shop. So they decided to go down and see him. They had no idea he said, don't come, or tell them not to come.
And I know it's a public place of business, but when your client entered with his friend, there was no business purpose to go there. I mean, they went there to talk with Mr. Becker about the upcoming city council vote.
Well, that's why they wanted to speak to Mr. Becker. But again, with going back to Ms. Polinchek's testimony, they asked her a number of questions about the shop's printing capabilities. Mr. Murillo was interested in using the shop services if the building got built to put, you know, in even contacts with local artists. We had asked about that. He wanted to use local artists and printing capabilities of that shop to provide decor for the facility once it was constructed. So there was a reasonable business purpose there, even if it wasn't the primary purpose of it. They wouldn't have spent however long, 15, 20 minutes in the first shop, if there was no business purpose to that. It would have just been, is he here? No? Okay, we'll leave. But they spent some time there. They asked her questions that, frankly, she said she wasn't prepared for and didn't really understand. But she answered to the best of her ability before saying, I'm not probably the best person to talk to about this. You should talk to Mr. Becker. They didn't seem threatening. They didn't seem hostile. They didn't seem anything of that nature, just excited about what they were there for. When they left, they went down to Mr. Becker's shop. They met again for 15 to 20 minutes before he asked them to leave. And when he asked them to leave, they promptly left without dispute, without fight, without argument, without disagreement. They said, okay, thanks for your time. And then they left. During the 15 minutes preceding that, there was nothing hostile. There was nothing threatening. There was nothing. It was described as cordial. And
for the most part, it was very cordial,
right?
I think was the testimony. But he said there were things that left him uncomfortable about enough that he contacted another city council member.
Left him uncomfortable, but not left him feeling threatened. And again,
you have to feel threatened to have been subject to an incident of harassment.
I think so. I think you do. Because otherwise, it wouldn't register. I mean,
what's your basis for thinking that? I'm looking at the statute.
Sure. Well, just going back to Durham's analysis of it, where it talks about Minnesota nice is not required. People are required to express outrage. This kind of language tells us people are allowed to say things that might make people feel uncomfortable without being subject to a harassment order. I mean, if everybody had to worry about saying whether they were going to be subject to a harassment order anytime they said anything uncomfortable, I shudder to think at what that would do to the speech of people in the state of Minnesota. I've said a number of things that I think are perfectly innocuous that apparently make other people feel uncomfortable. And I'm sure that's true for a great number of other people. So I think the statute requires, and the case law analysis of that statute shows, that the language has to be more than just, it made me feel a little uncomfortable and I talked to somebody about it later. It's got to be, that was really wrong and I feel threatened. I feel concerned for my safety at that time. Not going back a week or two later and saying, oh, well, in light of what this just happened, I don't know that wasn't more than what it was. I think it's an interesting and, frankly, dangerous standard to set that we can retroactively look at behavior when the people at the time didn't think enough of it to make a complaint at that time. I'm running low on time, so I'll just say that I think we need to look carefully at the objectivity standard and whether what was said here and what was done here really constitutes an objective threat to Mr. Becker's safety, security, or privacy.
All right, thank you. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, my name is Elizabeth Vieira, and I'm here today with my co-counsel, Amy Mace, on behalf of respondent John Becker. Mr. Becker is a member of the City Council of the City of Red Wing, and I think the most important thing for the court to keep in mind today is that the standard of review is abuse of discretion. Appellant gave you a lot of reasons why he doesn't think that the district court decided this case correctly, but all of them require you to reevaluate the way that the district court interpreted the testimony that he heard. And the findings of fact by district court are not set aside unless they're clearly erroneous, with a deference to the lower court's ability to judge credibility. So the standard to overturn this case is that the court has a definite and firm conviction that a mistake has been made.
Seems to me that the primary argument that I heard and saw in the briefs was that the district court got the law wrong and did not sort of apply an objective lens, if you will, to the facts as the court found them. How do you respond to that?
So what Cush v. Matheson says is that the harassment is judged from both an objective and a subjective lens. And the objective standard is assessing the effect that the conduct has on the typical victim. So when you look at the language that the court used when he said it was not unreasonable for Mr. Becker to feel that way, that's the court's finding that from an objective standard, that conduct made the victim, the conduct had that effect on the victim. But the second half of that, the subjective part of that language from Cush v. Matheson, says that it's a subjective standard to the extent the court may determine the harasser's intent. And the first sentence that the court says when he issues his ruling on the record is, I don't know what Mr. Murillo meant. So there, the court is telling you he couldn't determine the harasser's intent. So that takes out that second half of the Cush v. Matheson standard, because that says you only have to evaluate it from a subjective lens to the extent you can determine the harasser's intent. So by evaluating that subjective and objective standard, that's how the court is able to reach a conclusion that the incidents here constituted collectively repeated incidents of harassment. And speaking about this, the cordiality of the meeting, I think Judge Berkman, you're right to point out that Mr. Becker also said it was awkward and uncomfortable, and he wasn't sure why Mr. Murillo felt the need to bring up information about his personal life or information about an incident that occurred with his wife. So that, I think, gives credence to the district court's finding that this was an incident of harassment that led to Mr. Becker feeling very uncomfortable in his safety and security and privacy.
I want to ask you about that first encounter at the Rochester store on July 18th. I think the district court finding with respect to that encounter is that that was an uninvited visit to a business. How can a business that is open to the public be a setting where contact is uninvited?
Sure, and it has to do with the purpose for which Mr. Murillo entered the business. And the district court commented not only on the visit to the Rochester shop, but also the visit to the Red Wing shop first and then the Rochester shop. But in his testimony, Mr. Murillo said that he was not in the store for the purpose of transacting business with Mr. Becker because he didn't even know what Mr. Becker sold at the store. So it's, you know, Mr. Becker gave the example of a dentist office in his testimony, and it would be like if you walked into a dentist office and they said, oh, do you have an appointment? And you said, no, I'm just here to read the magazines in the waiting room. That it is a place that is open to the public that people can walk in, but they're there for a purpose. And in this case, Mr. Murillo's own testimony tells you that he was not there for the purpose of transacting business that that business performed. So that's where it is an uninvited visit. There's also two other factors that the court can consider in determining that it was uninvited that are in the record. The first is that Mr. Murillo did contact Mr. Becker previously to ask to make an appointment to meet with him. Mr. Becker said, I will get back to you. He never got back to him, and then the next thing that happens is Mr. Murillo and Mr. White show up uninvited at the store. The other way to know that it was uninvited is Ms. Polinchek's testimony tells us that she told Mr. Murillo in a customer service way that he should call ahead and make an appointment because she didn't know at that time that he wasn't a customer. So instead of saying, no, you shouldn't go to Rochester, John doesn't want to see you, she said she told him in a customer service way that he should really call ahead and make an appointment. And so to the extent that the district court was able to conclude that that's an uninvited visit, I think that that is supported by sufficient evidence in the record, or at least that there's not a definite and clear reason to overturn that finding that that was an uninvited visit.
Isn't it reasonable to believe that people who run for public office and are elected to do the public's business as a part-time job, that part and parcel of seeking that job is the knowledge that they will make themselves available to members of the public, whenever possible. That's just part of being a city council person, I think, is that whenever you're in the public place, you're likely going to be approached by people who have an interest in what the city council's doing, and people want to talk about it. If somebody wants to not have any contact with strangers of that type, they would never run for city council.
And I think that keeping in mind that they are part-time city council people, this is a job with a low stipend for the purpose of, you know, serving the public. I don't think that that is consent to be approached at any time in any place about council business. In the transcript, Mr. Becker talks about how he's always open to phone calls, he's open to emails, he'll talk to people in the grocery store. But when he's at his business, he wants to be working on his job. And I think in this case, it might be a little muddled because Mr. Becker owns his own business. But if you think about if Mr. Becker worked at a retail store, you wouldn't expect members of the public to go in and be able to talk to him about city council business when he's being paid by someone else for the purpose of doing a job. So he explained in the record that he is open and available to comments, but that he wants to do that at specific times. And he's also explained in there that he has told other people to leave his shop when they wanted to talk about city council business. So I do think that there is that being a public, an elected official, does not open you up to be questioned about all city council business at all hours without invitation or expressing a desire to engage in that conversation.
Isn't the issue really not so much the place and time, but rather the content of what he said? You know, his telling him about, the statement, which was credited by the district court, I know people in this foreign country, and we know how to take care of things, or whatever the message was. I mean, that was considered by the district court to be an ominous message, right?
It was, but to the extent that the order itself checks that box for uninvited visits to petitioner's place, or to, in that case, the petitioner's place of business, that's where I think the court made a finding that the conduct, because it doesn't have to be an overt threat, but the conduct in that case that led to a substantial effect on Mr. Becker's safety and security was the uninvited visits to his businesses.
Well, I mean, can we read we have a form order, and these form orders often don't give us a lot of reasoning or findings, but is it appropriate for us to read the form order in conjunction with the district court's oral statements at the hearing? I mean, the
yes.
district judge made statements that could be considered findings, right? I think you've quoted them already, but
Yes, I agree with that. So I think that the district court, so we checked the box for uninvited visits, but also discussed in his oral statements the effect that these behaviors cumulatively had on Mr. Becker's safety and security, to a point where Mr. Becker was talking about, you know, do we need mace in our shops because my employees, my wife, are now concerned about their safety in those locations as well. And I don't think that there is any question in terms of the second incident that the court found that it happened as Mr. Becker described, because the order itself references the petition that the petitioner filed that described that incident.
Mr. Henry argued that you really have to have words or conduct that gets to the level of being threatening to meet the statutory definition of harassment. Do you agree with that?
I don't, because that's not what the statute says. The statute says that it's repeated incidents that have a substantial adverse effect on the safety, security, and privacy of another.
Which is it here, safety, security, or privacy?
Yes, it's safety, security,
which?
Or privacy. In terms of the uninvited visits?
Well, which of those interests is implicated, safety, security, or privacy? Because it's in the disjunctive, I think it must be at least one of them, right?
I think it's all of them here. I think that we've talked about safety and security with respect to him thinking that he might need mace to protect his employees. We've talked about privacy with the Mr. Murillo's telling him about what he knew about his past. And, you know, Mr. Becker said—
Which he found on the internet, right?
Right, and it's not so much that he found it, but if you read Mr. Becker's testimony, he says, you know, as a salesman, I would do that research on somebody, but I don't understand why he felt the need to let me know that he knew that. So that's where it made Mr. Becker uncomfortable, is not that this information was known, but that Mr. Murillo felt that it was important that Mr. Becker knew that Mr. Murillo knew that information. So that's where it was a unwanted intrusion on his privacy as well. And so I think it is clear from the district court's findings.
I'm going to go back to that. I mean, I think public officials who seek election deserve to be safe and secure, but I think that part of the bargain is giving up privacy.
And I think
go ahead.
Even if the court doesn't want to find then that there was a violation of privacy, if we have a substantial adverse effect on safety and security, there's no need to also find a substantial effect on privacy. I do want to touch briefly on the Dunham v. Rohr constitutional issue here. So the decision in Dunham v. Rohr was a decision that the statute is not on its face unconstitutional. What appellant is really asking you to do is make an as-applied decision as to whether this statute, as applied to his client's conduct, is constitutional. That's not an argument he made to the district court. And in his brief at page 14, he tells you he's not making a constitutional claim here.
Is he really arguing that the conduct here, even if you accept Mr. Becker's version of the two encounters, just doesn't rise beyond Minnesota not nice situation, that does not rise to the level of being harassment as defined by the statute and explained by Dunham?
So I think there's two pieces to that. So the first is that it meets the statute, the language in the statute for being an incident of harassment, because the district court, in interpreting the testimony that the court heard, found that the conduct did rise to the level of having that substantial adverse effect. The application of Dunham v. Rohr is asking the court to apply a different rule than the statute is asking us to do. So it's almost like the reading Dunham backwards, that Dunham says language that is harassment is not constitutionally protected speech. And what the petitioner, what the appellant wants you to find is that you have to show that it is not constitutionally protected speech in order for it to be harassment. So here, and I think it's also helpful for the court to look at a couple other opinions in which the court interpreted Dunham. If you look at footnote 4 in Peterson v. Meyer, which I know is an unpublished case, but that case described Dunham v. Rohr as likening harassing conduct to fighting words or true threats. So I don't think that this court has held that there is an absolute standard. You have to meet the standard for fighting words. You have to meet the standard for true threats in order to prove harassment. That's also discussed somewhat in State v. Casillas, which came out in December. That involved the harassment by telephone statute. But if you look at the contrast that the court draws in that case between the harassment by telephone or the stalking by telephone and the harassment statute, it says it contrasts that by saying that the stalking by telephone statute does not only cover speech that is not protected by the First Amendment, in contrast to the harassment statute. So I don't think the way that appellant is asking you to interpret Dunham is consistent with the way that the court has interpreted that case in the past. So I do just want to briefly address the return back to the standard of review in this case, that appellant hasn't shown you any definite and firm reason to believe that the district court erred in making its decision. Its findings were not clearly erroneous. They were based on the district court's ability to interpret and understand the testimony that was in front of it. So with that in mind, I'd ask that the court affirm the district court's decision.
Thank you. Mr. Henry, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. Briefly, with respect to the constitutionality argument that you pointed out, that's exactly the argument that we're making, the one you just posed, is that we're not making any claim that Mr. Murillo's constitutional rights were infringed on. We're not making a constitutional argument. Merely the Durham v. Rohr specifically outlines Minnesota NICE is not required. The statute, if we're just looking at words, because the rest of the cases cited by the respondent involve words and actions. Welsh, for example, was a case where the respondent only said, or the appellant only said, God loves you and so do I. Now, that's objectively, in my opinion, but objectively, it's not threatening words. But the conduct was at the respondent's home, and it was the words and the conduct in conjunction where they based the order on that.
Well, context is important in all of these cases.
Absolutely.
Words can mean different things or have different intended meanings depending on the context.
And I think some of that context may have been ignored by the district court, and whether that's clearly erroneous or an abuse of discretion, that's up for you to decide. I would argue it is, but that's obviously my job. The clearer question is, was the law properly applied here? And that's done de novo. That's for you to look at and decide. Did the district court, in analyzing the case and considering all the testimony and considering the context, did they apply the law correctly? Did they apply the objective standard correctly? Did they apply the standard of true threats correctly? Respondent wants us to read backwards the Durham standard, saying all harassing conduct is unconstitutional speech. I don't think that's even remotely close to what the First Amendment says. Again, I'm not making a constitutional argument here. I just think that's a misinterpretation of the law. Similarly, with Cush v. Matheson, there's the dual standard there. There's the objective standard, the objective conduct on the part of the person who's allegedly doing the harassing, the way the recipient objectively takes that standard. And then there's the subjective part. It's not a two-part test. It's that the court can also consider the subjective intent of the person making the statements or committing the conduct.
Because that's what the statute says when
Correct.
It defines harassment.
Yeah, the objective and the subjective standards are not mutually dependent upon each other. You don't need to look at both to analyze it. You can look at the objective and then say, well, what did they say? You can consider the subjective, but you can't consider the subjective reactions of the person receiving the words or the conduct. Anybody can overreact. I mean, if Mr. Becker felt like he needed to go out and get mace after the city council hearing, I'm not going to question that. Sure, that's fine. But whether that's because of what Mr. Murillo said or whether that's just his response to it, Mr. Murillo can't control his response to what Mr. Murillo said. He can only control what he said. And again, what he said was, I said, you pray, I'll pray. We need to pray over this. And if Mr. Becker took that the wrong way, he also ignored the chief of police, the county attorney, and a police detective who also said there's no threatening behavior here. I think that's the very objective testimony that the district court also heard and considered that should have been considered in light of what Mr. Becker was claiming here. And I don't want to get into Mr. Becker's reasons for applying for this HRO or what his purpose was in doing so. That's not my place to speculate on. But I will say it's a matter of public record that the deal Mr. Murillo had with Mayo was canceled after this was done. I think that's worth noting. I don't think Mr. Murillo, after spending a year of his life putting this deal together, would have wanted to throw it away based on a couple offhand comments. And there's really nothing in the record that would show that he said anything objectively threatening, at least on multiple occasions. Maybe the city council hearing was threatening. Maybe that, you know, Mr. Becker clearly took it that way. Mr. Emilio says he didn't intend it that way. Three people said it wasn't threatening, but maybe it was objectively threatening behavior. But it's one instance. Then we have to go back in time to a previous occurrence that everybody said was cordial, non-threatening, a little weird, sure. She brought up the fact that Mr. Murillo had done his homework on Mr. Becker and done some Google research on him. It's all publicly available that he found. And Mr. Becker said, I can understand why a salesman would want to do their research before going out and meeting, but it just seemed weird that he would bring it up. Well, that's Mr. Becker's opinion, that it was weird to bring it up. Mr. Murillo testified that he's done business in a dozen countries, and the way he does business is to develop personal relationships with his customers and clients. By speaking to Mr. Becker about his own history, he was trying to develop that relationship, saying, I understand where you're coming from. I see how you got into public life. I see what brought you in your life to where you're at now, and I'm trying to relate to you on those grounds. That's why I'm bringing this up. I think Mr. Becker even said he can understand why he would have told him. It just seemed weird that he did. I don't think something that seems weird to the person hearing it, but he could understand why, he just didn't make sense to him, would be grounds for threatening behavior to meet the criteria for harassment restraining order. I'm out of time, and I want to thank the court for their time in considering this matter. Thank you.
Thank you both. We'll take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period. Next matter on the calendar for oral